The Ex-Worker. An audio strike against a monotone world. A twice-monthly podcast of anarchist ideas and action. For everyone who dreams of a life off the clock. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning back in to The Ex-Worker. We've got a special episode lined up for you this time. As you may know, the Crime Think To Change Everything tour, featuring an international anarchist panel discussion, wrapped up in mid-November after over 2 months on the road and events in dozens of cities. Well over 2,000 people across the so-called United States got to hear the panel and participate in discussion, including many of you listeners, we hope. But for the benefit of all you who weren't able to be at one of the events, plus for anyone who did make it and wants to re-engage with the ideas or continue the conversation, we're offering up a full live audio recording of the To Change Everything panel discussion as our 44th episode of the Ex-Worker podcast. For many years, the Crime Think Ex-Workers Collective has been a point of connection and collaboration between anarchists around the world. Through the Crime Think blog and website, the journal Rolling Thunder, the Ex-Worker podcast, various speaking tours, and face-to-face projects, we've made an effort to connect people, projects, groups, and struggles across borders to support translations of our English language material into other languages, as well as circulating English translations of anarchist analysis produced elsewhere. In a moment when events across the globe can act as inspirations and flashpoints for rebellions thousands of miles away, it seems more important than ever to be reporting and reflecting on resistance on an intercontinental scale. In that spirit, we undertook the To Change Everything project, our most ambitious collaboration yet. Collectives spanning 5 continents and over 25 languages work together to produce a multimedia introduction to anarchist ideas, including a print publication, interactive website, video, stickers, audio zine, social media presence, events, and tours. Here in the US, we printed 150,000 copies in English, plus another 25,000 in Spanish, and circulated them for months in anticipation of a US tour that would build face-to-face connections among folks passionate about anarchist resistance. Since the project was international in scope from the beginning, we wanted the tour to reflect that. So, we assembled a group of anarchists who had been involved in production and circulation of To Change Everything in their local context, and brought them to the US to share reflections on the struggles going on where they live. The tour included participants from To Change Everything collectives in Slovenia, Brazil, the Czech Republic, and, for some stops, Argentina, along with some ex-workers from here in the US. The stories they shared touched on some of the most pressing and complex themes in resistance struggles today. The role of making demands, the concept of autonomy, what's at stake when we frame struggles within the discourse of democracy, the renewed rise of nationalism and fascism, international solidarity, and what anarchists and anti-authoritarians have to offer in these vastly different but interconnected contexts across the globe. This recording comes from the final stop of the tour at Firestorm Cafe and Books in Asheville, North Carolina. After a brief introduction from the local organizer, you'll hear one of the U.S.-based ex-workers give some context for the project and the panel, followed by Ramona from Slovenia, Zay from Brazil, and Sasha from the Czech Republic. Another ex-worker concludes the panel by tying together the different themes and reflecting on them in a U.S. context. After the panel discussion, you'll hear a brief excerpt from the question and answer portion of the event, in which the panelists discuss the process of collaboration, translation, and distribution of To Change Everything in their respective countries. Afterward, stay tuned for some of our ideas about how to continue the dialogue, whether or not you are able to make it to one of the events this fall, and an invitation to contribute to our upcoming Year in Review episode. We hope you enjoy it. Now, without further ado, the To Change Everything tour.
So, welcome to Firestorm. For anyone that doesn't know, we're a 7-year-old anarchist cooperative here in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're really thrilled tonight to have folks from the To Change Everything tour. I'm going to let y'all introduce yourselves, but I just wanted to, start with a round of applause and appreciation for coming so far to be here. And I'll turn it over.
Hello, and welcome. Thank y'all so much for coming. Thank you for having us here in Asheville. We're thrilled to be here, thrilled to be in the fancy, glossy new Firestorm. Congratulations on this beautiful space. So I want to start off by telling you a little bit about who we are, why we're here, what this tour is about, and what the project is about, what anarchism is, and what the program this evening is going to look like. So, to get started, To Change Everything is an international anarchist collaboration, an outreach project spanning many continents that takes the form of this pamphlet that we've produced. There's many, many thousands of copies that we've printed, so please feel free to take some home. And this project is not just something that we're touring the U.S. circulating. It's been translated into over 25 different languages, from French to Spanish to Arabic to Tagalog and many others. And we are here to share this international project with some international perspectives. We've got a panel discussion assembled with folks who have been participants in social movements in different places around the world that have integrated anarchist ideas, anarchist tactics, and anarchist questions, and also folks who have participated in the To Change Everything project as translators and folks who've brought these ideas and these concepts into their local contexts. So, since we mentioned that this is an international anarchist project, we want to start off by telling you a little bit about how we see anarchism, what that means to us. So, anarchism is the pulse inside every human heart that beats in time with freedom and out of step with authority. It's the simple idea that no one is more qualified than you to determine how you should live your life. That our lives can be sweetest when no one can wield power over anyone else. Depending on what your exposure is to anarchists in the media, you may have an image in your head of folks who run cooperative bookstores or hand out food in the park or dress up in black and break windows. But tonight we're not going to be talking about anarchism just as a toolbox or a set of tactics. Instead, we're going to be focusing on anarchism as a set of questions that we can ask to evaluate our movements and our struggles, an approach to our efforts to change the world. We see anarchism as a practice of being ungovernable, a practice of preventing any external authority from imposing itself on us and the ones that we love. So, tonight we're not going to be talking about anarchism as a set of abstract ideas. We're going to get concrete and practical by looking at how these concepts, how these questions and these lenses have been relevant in social upheavals happening around the world. As all of you know, since 2011 with the Arab Spring and spreading into the Occupy movement, the movement in the plazas, from Turkey to Brazil to Ukraine to many other places in the world, we're in an era of global crisis and global resistance. So we need to have a global lens to understand what's happening and to assess how these ideas and concepts might be relevant. So to that end, we have Ramona, who's here from the Balkans in southeastern Europe, who's going to be sharing experiences with some upheavals there that you may not have heard of. Many of you have heard about Greece and the anti-austerity protests and riots happening there, but you may be less familiar with resistance happening in smaller countries like Slovenia and Bosnia, where powerful uprisings have even overthrown governments and used directly democratic assemblies as a way of discussing and making decisions in these movements. So we'll hear reflections on the upheavals happening there and also some of the limitations that come up when we rely on the language of democracy inside of social upheavals. We also have Z, who's here from Brazil, who's going to talk about the protests that erupted in 2013 in response to the government's efforts to raise the cost of public transportation. From these massive uprisings that brought millions of people into the streets in over 100 cities, to the following year in the World Cup in 2014 when folks protested that as well, and new challenges that have come up in new efforts to increase transportation costs just this year. We'll hear about some of the limitations of basing our political movements on single demands and reflections on the concept of autonomy and what that could mean to us. Also, we have Sasha, who's here from the Czech Republic in Central Europe, who's going to be sharing stories about the rise of nationalism and fascism in those contexts and what that has to do with war, militarism, racism, and the so-called migrant crisis or refugee crisis happening in Europe. And we'll also hear about what international solidarity could look like and what anarchists are doing. So as we share these stories from around the world tonight, we don't want you all to relate to them as exotic, faraway struggles that are maybe interesting, but not necessarily relevant to what's going on here in Asheville or in North Carolina. Because the reason why we're touring throughout the U.S., this is our very last stop on a nationwide tour of over 50 cities, the reason why we're bringing these stories here is because we think that many of the same questions, many of the same challenges that these folks are encountering in their social movements in different parts of the world are actually directly related and parallel to the kinds of struggles that we're encountering here in the U.S. So after the panel discussion, we hope that you'll stick around if you're able for a discussion where we can share local experiences about what resonated in terms of the themes and the questions from Slovenia to Brazil to the Czech Republic and right here in North Carolina. So thank you all so much for being here.
Hi, everyone. My name is Ramona. I'm from Slovenia. If you're not exactly sure where that country is, don't be upset because it's a small place in Northern Balkans. Slovenia went through ethnic war in the beginning of the 90s, and that marked the transition from socialist Yugoslavia to the kind of democracy only capitalism really knows how to offer. And of course, if anarchists were not really present because of the political restrictions in the era during socialism, we definitely became a part of every major social struggle in Slovenia since the war, since the independence. One of the biggest moments of such struggles was the uprising that happened in 2012-2013. Those were 6 months of the biggest decentralized anti-authoritarian uprising that, among other things, also overthrew government. And that kind of brought us to be a part of the cartography of uprisings that are happening all around the world in the last 5 to 7 years, from Arab Spring to Occupy to here in the United States, Ferguson and Baltimore, and so on. It seems that one of the things that is binding those uprisings all around the world is actually the question of democracy. Some movements are taking legitimacy away from their leaders, from representative democracy, and are somehow building up a new kind of structures where of mass experimentation with direct democracy. But this direct democracy and these experiments have also proven not to be sufficient enough, especially during Occupy. So therefore, we have started to think in the uprising after some of those experiences in Slovenia and also beyond in the Balkans, how can we actually not just be critical towards direct democracy, but also invent a new kind of language that would battle the negative effects that democracy is bringing to our social movements? So tonight I would like to speak to you all about the question of autonomy as an alternative to the language of democracy. Okay, in November 2012, it was a cold November night when the first radars started to burn in the second largest city in Slovenia because corrupt mayor installed those radar machines that measure speed of cars and then fine you if you're over speeding on basically every major crossroad in the city. And in just a matter of a few days, a whole bunch of people lost all their savings, all their income, because they couldn't afford to pay those tickets. And that got a lot of people angry. And the way that they dealt with that anger was that they went and literally destroyed radar by radar during the night. And that soon turned into a very popular sport during weekends. And if you go on YouTube, you can see a whole bunch of different ways how to do it. But those burnings and destructions soon became socially contextualized in protest, first against corruption and corrupted mayor, but then also against general conditions in our society, against poverty, against austerity measures, in some extent also against capitalism and other forms of oppression. They soon gained a national character, and there were people coming to the streets in places that they never came to the streets before. And people were clashing with the police, and things got burned. We occupied a whole bunch of land and buildings and so on. And especially the first few weeks of this uprising were particularly unpredictable. There were no demands. People didn't want to negotiate. There was no representatives. And it wasn't just the authorities that got really confused by this demandless movement, but it was also some of the people within the uprising that were coming from the middle class, who was, until the crisis in 2008, 2009, relatively privileged and definitely didn't start uprising that was started by people who were most targeted in our society. But those people felt that they are a little bit confused by this new terrain of struggle. So they wanted the movement to go back to the old ways of politics, where you have demands, where you have representatives, where you negotiate with the government, and then you get a little something in return. Anarchists, we felt that we need to stop this from happening, because we knew that as soon as we entered the politics of demands, we're going to create a situation where after a wonderful experience of so many people finally having some control over their lives while they were struggling on the streets, we would again be addressing the state as the only agent of change in our society. Not even to mention that if you have thousands and thousands of people each coming to the streets with their own needs, desires, visions for the society, and then you go and say, you know, we only need three demands, you of course have to say your demand matters, but your demand can wait for a better time. That creates hierarchy in the movement, and that also alienates a lot of people who no longer feel that they are a part of the uprising. So when we were thinking how can we stop those demands from happening, we learned that in Occupy years before that, that whoever wants to represent the movement, they will probably be seeking some kind of legitimacy. And in Occupy, that legitimacy was always given in General Assembly, where it was democratically decided what it is that, you know, Occupy or the camp or the movement wants. And everything that was happening outside of that space of General Assembly, outside of democratic decision-making, was seen as illegitimate. So we were expecting people to try to introduce demands on the General Assemblies, so we said, well, how about we call for General Assemblies first? But we make those assemblies not space of decision-making, not space that concentrates power in the institution rather than disperse it among everyone in the uprising, but rather we would create General Assembly as a space of convergence, where we can come together, where we can build trust, build community, talk and find other people who think like us or challenge our ideas. And we have managed to succeed. Demands were never issued as on the level of the movement. And I think that is important, because that means that the uprising was never reduced to a set of demands, but rather remained an open space. And because it was not a single issue campaign, it gave all of us who wanted to experiment with what it means to go beyond the existing democratic structure a lot of space to actually do that and see where that will lead us. But also, as intense as uprising was, we knew that in just one big upheaval, we won't be able to overthrow the state or capitalism or racism or patriarchy or any other forms of oppression in our society. We knew that new battles will come, so we wanted to make sure that we are going out of the uprising stronger than we went in, with more people that we know, with more social ties, with more experiences, with more knowledge, and also with an example of what it means to struggle, and that confronting the state on the streets is not the way that we are defeated because we haven't achieved some kind of, you know, demand-oriented little victory, but is actually the way that we can advance our struggles. Okay, I will bring you now to my second example of an uprising that followed in a year later, in spring 2014, in Bosnia, and was even more intense than the uprising in Slovenia. Bosnia particularly suffered through ethnic war. There was genocide, and for a really long time, everything in Bosnia was separated. And there was not a lot of spaces where people would meet beyond their lines of ethnicity. The only way that politicians were able to maintain control over people in the years after the war was basically by trying to even deepen those divisions on ethnic lines. And in 2014, people said enough to this kind of nationalism. And they came to the streets in numbers never seen before, and they burned down parliament and governmental buildings and offices of mayors and city council all over the councils all over the country and headquarters of political parties that were the symbol of their division and oppression. After showing so much strength on the street, some people felt that they need to open up another space, that riots are not enough, that they want to have a space where you can talk calmly with people around you. And in the beginning, assemblies proved to be everything that you could possibly want from directly democratic bodies. They were massive, more than 1,000 people at the time, happening simultaneously all over the country. No political parties were allowed to speak. They were promoting gender equality. Functions were rotating. People, for the first time, could actually be heard, about their problems, about their war experiences, about their poverty, and so on. But all of that did not prevent assemblies from, instead of being tools of the movement, to actually becoming some kind of weapon against it. The problem was that, as massive as they were not including everyone. Because some people felt, they didn't want to be competing, perhaps, on the same podium for a word with people who are much more educated than they are. Other people felt that they don't want to engage in demand-oriented politics, because quite soon the assemblies actually became the place where people were trying to coordinate demands throughout the country, what it is that the movement wants. Some people said, you know what, we burned down the parliament. What else is there to say? But that, of course, created a situation where assemblies, despite the best wishes of people who are most active in it, became the agenda setters for everyone. And that, of course, alienated some people. And there is no coincidence that the more people participated in the assemblies, less people there were confronting state on the streets. So when assemblies, after weeks of really hard work of coordinating demands, presented those demands to the government, government just put the list into a drawer and never looked at it again, because when they looked through the window, there was absolutely no one left on the street to beg those demands. The moment was gone. The movement was dead. I think that the most important lesson from Bosnian uprising that has truly inspired many uprisings that followed in the Balkans afterwards as an example of what it means to fight against nationalism and what it means to show strength on the street, I think that the most important lesson is that our strength doesn't lie in our ability to gather mass amount of people into democratic decision-making process. Instead of that, our strength lies in our capacity to act autonomously, and with those autonomous actions, also to be able to protect the gains of our struggles. With other words, we have to know when we are strong. When we create a situation like people in Bosnia did with their courageous actions, where politicians were already sending their families across the border, absolutely certain that their last hour is about to come, you do not take a step back and ask for little things under the table when you can have the whole bread. Okay, but if democracy is obviously not working, what actually was that got us to think how autonomy would in certain situations be actually working for us differently, more successfully? I'm going to bring you back to 2011, to Slovenia, to my last example of an assembly that was happening in university in Ljubljana, the capital of Slovenia, where government wanted to introduce tuitions into otherwise free higher education system, and we were packed in the assembly with only one item on the agenda: whether or not to occupy university. Anarchists, we felt that we need to go and really make a statement, that we need to shut down university completely, that we need to create the kind of rupture that would truly stop the production of knowledge from happening. And we felt that that would open up enough space for us to articulate not just what we want in terms of, defending autonomy of university and free education, but also to question what is university and what kind of privilege does it produce and for who. But a lot of people felt that we were being too radical, that what we need to do is to only occupy 3 classrooms, you know, and if things don't work, then we would go and really show our strength and occupy everything else. Well, we were not really bound to these people with anything. We were not, you know, in the same organization. Some people we didn't even know. But we felt that if we are participating in directly democratic process, we need to somehow respect the decision that is made in the assembly. So even though we didn't agree, we went and we occupied those few classrooms. A few weeks later, everyone just left, you know, the university and the classrooms quietly, because the occupation was so insignificant that no one even bothered to evict it. You know, they just moved classes to another location. So it almost seemed that the only thing that truly came out of that was some kind of collective depression and the fact that not a single classroom has been occupied in Slovenia since 2011. But I guess that was the democracy. Looking back, what I think we should have done in that situation was to say, you want to go and occupy those 3 classrooms? We'll help you. But everyone who wants to go and occupy the remaining part of university afterwards, let's just gather in that corner and let's start building barricades. Would we be successful?
I don't know.
But I know for sure that we would be following our needs, our desires, our vision, our strategy. I know that we would definitely not be seeking for the permission of an authority of General Assembly that paradoxically we created ourselves and was not even imposed on us. I know I have been very critical towards direct democracy and the assemblies, but I still think that we need to find moments to come together, collectively somehow create some, you know, collective actions. But I think that it's very important that we do not understand those moments of coming together as spaces of democracy, but rather as an opportunity to experiment with the new methodology of autonomy. If you think about some of the most inspirational struggles that we have seen in the last few years, like Ferguson, for example, not a single of those uprisings ever started with a democratic vote, or people gathered in General Assembly for a really long time discussing what is legitimate or illegitimate to do. All of those uprisings started from a very honest rage of people who, with their courageous actions, opened up space for a lot of different voices to be heard and for a lot of different ideas to be articulated. So thank you so much for listening, and I am looking forward for our discussion.
Boa noite. My name is Z, from Brazil, from São Paulo. We're glad to be here. This is the last presentation after 2 months on the road. 50-something talks, so it has a special taste. This presentation is like a mission complete. So sorry for the internal jokes. We're very excited. And then I will bring some reflections about the word autonomy and the autonomous movements in Brazil, which is like this environment, this network where anarchists and anti-capitalists are in Brazil, and they were the responsible for the last 3 years of the most important struggles and fights and waves of unrest in the last 3 years in Brazil. 2013, fight against the fare hike, when governments of many cities and many states were putting up the price of buses and metro, and a kind of demonstration that happens every year when it happens became a nationwide uprising and an opportunity for new tactics, new strategies, and anarchist methodologies spread all over the country. The next year, we are excited going from 2013 to right to the protest to resist the World Cup, the FIFA World Cup, and all the mega events and the impacts in Brazil, especially in the most affected communities, the more poor and marginalized communities. And this year, among many other struggles in January of this year, we have another fare hike, the opportunity to fight against in the same terrain, the same place we won our last big victory, and see what is still working and what should change in our strategies and narratives. So in 2013, to understand basically what we did, what happened there, was in June of 2013, some demonstrations were called against the 20-cent increase in public transportation. And For the first time, after 1 month of struggle, we could achieve a victory as autonomous movements. And I mean, like, spreading this anarchist ethics of autonomy, horizontality, consent, direct action, and going to the streets and inviting people to fight on the streets along us and sharing all these skills and all these strategies without any party, any union, any traditional social movement, any traditional like left being like in front of everything. So for the first time we saw that people were like for the first time considering like use this tactics and go beyond the traditional model, hierarchical and centralized model of the left. After it was a huge thing, after like 12 years of Workers' Party, the left in power, and the streets like empty and all the movements being like held back after helping the Workers' Party to get in power. And we saw this like protagonism of the autonomous movement and this anarchist tactics, where that we saw like the window of possibility being like more open, and we saw many other radical activity happening. We saw black blocs becoming a trend all over the country. People were like using this crazy tactics of dressing black with masks, fighting back the police brutality, smashing the banks and corporations, and surrounding the palaces with the politicians inside all over the country, the most important cities. We saw this. This was a door for many, many people to go to the first time on the streets. Actually, an entire generation were in the streets for the first time after being raised under the Workers' Party government. And many of those people who were like in black blocs on the streets were there for the first time on the streets. So it was a door for many people to know or be involved in some struggle, like with through the most radical of the tactics on the streets. And we saw many of our, it was important to see how many of our comrades that don't fit this profile that is still dominant, even the autonomous movements, the white male middle class student that lives in the downtown and have all the resources to be the full time activist, all those who don't fit this, all our black comrades or comrades that live like very far away from in the urban area, or our queer comrades, were fighting each other, building a power and making the difference on the streets through this more spontaneous and ephemeral actions. We saw a contamination effect, like after this victory, people are wanting to join, to be on the streets for all reasons, for the most radical to the most conservative. People were like, we want something, and it was like just people, just normal people, and no like huge movement. We can do more of this, so people want to be on the streets. And we are hearing about the crisis of representation, crisis of democracy, like for the first time in years, when like they realized that all the palaces were trying to be burned down, so maybe the politicians and the left, all the parties don't have this ties anymore with the society, and especially with the youth. It was shocking for the left to realize this. And we had, like, in the end of June, we had like 100 cities rioting or having demonstrations, even cities that didn't even have any fare hike. They were like, the entire country is burning, let's burn things here too. And they put down the price of tickets, of buses and stuff. And 3-4 million people on the streets, according to official statistics. And of course, we are not 3-4 million anarchists on the streets. We are a bunch of people from different backgrounds, including some people with a very weird taste for fashion, like with the national flag as a cape, soccer shirts, and buying beers and V masks, and taking selfies with the police. So we were like considering that we are not in the same page, but after the selfies with the police, we saw that we don't want the same thing, maybe. And it didn't take that much time, so then start to like show people to the police, these are the vandals, or protecting the banks or other property. So when many conflicts emerge in the streets, after this victory, we need to understand what we are doing. Like, what happened? The autonomous movements, especially the Free Pass movements, they bring this heritage of anarchist and autonomous or horizontal organizations like federalization, autonomy, horizontal decisions like consent, direct action. and the lack of connection, like be not connected with parties or government or anything, any institution. And the idea of being like this is like the basic anarchist like proposal that we should be right now, organize ourselves right now the way we want to be organized in the future after some revolution, zombie apocalypse, whatever you call. And then we were like all these movements and the anarchists inside this have this narrative that we should like act this way, or all these movements should act this way to be a reference for other people, for other movements, that it's possible to fight or to organize the resistance outside this pyramid model of the left. But we never know what happens with our wishes until the day they come true. We saw that a narrative were being built to understand what we did, and especially the narrative that goes around the specific demand. Like the main narrative was that the metaphor was the 20 cents, like the price of the fare hike, that all the movements now should follow this example of the free pass movement, that they achieved a victory because they could like invite people to the streets with a specific demand, an achievable demand, a reasonable demand that we can like show to everyone, this is our 20 cents and fight for this, and in a short-term struggle we all can like taste the small victories and eventually change the whole society one demand at a time, one 20 cents at a time. And of course not everybody agreed with this narrative, but was the main narrative, like many people were talking about this. But anyway, we were excited. This was the first victory like beyond any traditional pattern of social movements like in Brazil. We're very excited. Like the anarchists were thinking, this is the anarchist turn, because our tactics were like used by some of these autonomous movements who has like anarchists inside. It's not actually an anarchist movement, but has these principles and these tactics. And all the people are now joined to the streets and wanting to keep this kind of organizing. And after 12 years of Workers' Party in power, nothing changed. The left didn't do anything like significant for people. We have like 30 million people outside of the poverty line. Of course, like people are still poor, but now with big televisions and cell phones and smartphones. But neoliberal economy growing as never, all the banks with record of profit and stuff. And we're like excited and looking forward to the other June to come, June of 2014, the World Cup. We should like understand like the World Cup, the mega events like Olympic Games that will happen in Brazil next year, World Expo that São Paulo were trying to host in 2020 but they lost, like all the three biggest mega events of the world Brazil was trying to host in one single decade. And they are not like just party, just opportunity to advertising and billboards in the cities or stupid guys running for a ball. They are like much more complex mechanism to reshape the cities, to implement economical and political changes, to implement like new laws as the criminalization of demonstrations, terrorist laws, etc. And all the governments, that's why like all governments, especially from third world, like from recent or fragile democracy as South Africa, Brazil now, and the future Russian, Arab Emirates, all them want to host the World Cup, want to host like mega events to implement these changes that otherwise they wouldn't have the excuse if it wasn't this nationalist approach and this discourse of legacy of World Cup. So we saw the Workers' Party like working hard to host the World Cup. And of course, you cannot like remove 200,000 people from their house without compensation, like as in Brazil, put like women and children from poor populations and in a vulnerable situation because of sex work and all this stuff that increase and happens a lot because all these motherfucking gringos that go to Brazil. Like, you cannot do all those things without to implement a global model of city, like to update this model without global model of police, too, without implementing the repression forces, the repressive forces, the laws. We saw the first sign we saw was the pacification of the favelas, where the army and the police were together pacifying, occupying the favelas, saying that they will evict all the drug cartels and prepare the terrain for the mega events, make it more peaceful for business. And then all these operations show that the agenda of the army and the police were like getting unified, and unified with other forces too. The police in Brazil were getting training, drones, trucks, weapons, everything from Israel, French army, German army, and from here, from Blackwater and FBI. We could show our frustration. I hope you all heard about the resistance, like the soccer nation against the FIFA World Cup happening in Brazil. We are there, we are on the streets, but we saw and we learned that expectations is not enough. If we don't build ties, if we don't build our popular struggle, like of popular strength, I mean, in a more ambitious way, that is not just a militant way, like military way. If you don't do this, we cannot like face such a big enemy. We were there, but we couldn't prevent FIFA to go back home with the most profitable World Cup ever made, but the most expensive, more expensive than the last three World Cups altogether, and one of the most violent, one of the most absurd World Cups ever made. But anyway, we have always a reason to be on the streets. We can learn from even from our defeats. We wish we can like get away, get out of this moment like stronger. And many other fights were happening, many other struggles. You have always a reason to be in the streets or organizing. And then in January of this year, we had another fare hike, and this time 50 cents. So a bigger metaphor for those who like metaphors, not just 20 cents. And we didn't see like more and more people even more angry on the streets. We saw the opposite of June of 2013. We saw less and less and less people going to the streets. In the end, was just the free pass movement in the rain, like alone. No one were there to back this struggle. And then we realized, we start to consider that we are fighting a new terrain. Brazil is not like that giant growing anymore. We're facing a recession. We were facing a recession that time. Now we are totally in. And we saw that many other reforms were being implemented to like make less people join the streets, like free transportation for public schools and public universities before the fare hike, so less people to get angry on the streets. We saw like a media blackout, no one was talking about demonstrations anymore. It's not like that nice now to do the spectacle about like police repression, all this stuff, because they realize this catalyzes solidarity. We saw that the streets are very divided now. All these people, like I say, that there were like 3-4 million people on the streets, 100 cities, in the end of June. This time, people had like different reasons to be on the streets, and not everyone will attend any demonstration. Now, like those weird people with the bad taste for clothing, now they march by themselves, taking even more selfies with the police. All those things, we realized that they now march by themselves. One thing that was important for this was that in the end of 2014, we have the elections for president. So Workers' Party trying to keep the seats, right wing going, trying to take it back. And many autonomous movements were like making this campaign, all the left, of course, but autonomous movements and even anarchists doing the campaign to like vote for the Workers' Party, at least it's better than the right wing back in power. We lost the opportunity to talk about the crisis of representation, to explore this issue and say that it doesn't matter who is in power. They will be against us and against the most affected people. Dilma, the president, the women who were related to the guerrilla groups during the dictatorship that was arrested and tortured, now she sent the army to the favelas to pacify the favelas for the World Cup. Like, it doesn't matter who is in power. Once you get there, then we lost the opportunity to talk about it. And what we saw is that this polarization between institutional politics were very profitable for this new right wing, that now many of the people were on the streets, sharing the streets in 2013, learning some skills, like acting in a decentralized way, invite demonstrations, like in an autonomous way, because they don't wait for parties, for traditional movements or any other institution. Now these institutions, the parties and everybody, were trying to follow their agenda and say to them what they want to hear. And we saw that, and they have their own 20 cents too. They want the impeachment of the president. Sometimes they're very specific and very explicit about the return of the military dictatorship. So that was in Brazil until the 80s. So we realized that many of this autonomous movement tactics were being used, were being like updated and used by these new people. Then the main question for us now is like, when we talk about autonomy, when we want to be like autonomous movements and spread our methodologies, we should like be explicit about the long-term perspectives, or at least like open the debate for this. Otherwise, we'll be sharing the tools, sharing the moments, sharing the streets, the skills, everything with those who don't want the same thing in the future. And we'll be, they will be with us until they find something more efficient or more reasonable, or someone that say they can grant this kind of reform in a better way, in a more efficient way, even the most fascist way. So when we talk about autonomy, we should question ourselves too. Autonomy from what? From each relations, from each institutions, each behaviors, and for what? What do we want to achieve with our autonomy? It's like just the way we do the same thing that everybody's doing, but now it's more horizontal. When we make all those questions and what, like about what do we want to do, how do we want to do, maybe we consider that all those teenagers who are on the streets for the first time in black blocks, they were like fighting the police, smashing the banks, smashing the palaces. All them were showing a long-term commitment bigger than any 20 cents. They were like showing that you cannot like ask the state to disappear. You cannot ask the state to be less state, or you cannot ask the police to be less violent, to be less a tool for white supremacy. We should organize ourselves right now to make all those relations and institutions obsolete and grow our own power. Instead of demand, take, instead of ask, like organize. Maybe all these new windows, new opportunities that were being opened or broken, all this will be like open the cracks in this political desert as any, any pioneer vegetation opened the way in a desert, in a real desert, for new grass, bushes, trees in a future forest to show up. So here, with a project like this, with a exhausting and demanding and fun tour like this, we're trying to keep these cracks open new more, share the seeds for this new trees you wanna have in our gardens, whatever. Compare notes and whatever. So thank you for joining us. Whatever, no. I didn't want to finish with whatever, so see you on the streets or any other battlefield you choose.
Dobrý večer. Good evening in your language. I can't believe that this is the last talk of this over 2 months long tour. Not that I will be counting, but together with you, we spoke to 2,483 people. So thank you all for coming.
Not that we are counting.
Nah, we're not counting, really. My name is Sasha. I come from Eastern Central Europe, Czech Republic. That's right next to Germany. And I'll say something about how mostly racism and militarization and police repression play important role in growing nationalism. And I'll show some examples how to fight against it. Okay, let's take it back to history. Did you guys hear about communist revolution?
I didn't.
Basically, you and your comrades start to fight and masses start to fight against all the institutions of oppression and state. You do all the hard work, you lose a lot of comrades, falling in a battlefield, and when you turn it towards more the liberation and horizontal society, and everything looks good. I mean, so far so good, right? Communists show up. They steal the revolution, they put you and all those who still want total liberation in a prison, in a better case, or kill the rest, and they set up one-party military dictatorship. That's a communist revolution in short. And this happened in Czech Republic just right after Second World War, and it ended up in 1989 when the Berlin Wall fell down. And then Eastern Europe transitioned from very painful and oppressive one-party socialism, or this communist dictatorship, into very painful and oppressive to choose your party neoliberal capitalism. And in that time, many things changed, but one of some things remained the same, and one of them was ongoing mandatory recruitment and need of having strong army. Only what changed that the weapons turned basically overnight 180 degrees. The aim stopped to be against the West and started to be against the East. And that, of course, didn't happen on its own. It took no time when USA and other Western empires showed the interest in the Eastern Europe, and in a few years, country by country, joined UN and NATO. Despite the fact that 10 years ago mandatory draft was cancelled, I was really happy I didn't have to serve military. Now I see that nothing had really changed about the militarization. The export of arms and military equipment has been increasing every year, and it was after this cancellation when Czech professional army joined USA in occupying Iraq and Afghanistan. As well, with new regime, many new things appeared. And I don't mean Kelly family or crime film. That all came much later. I'm talking about fascism. And unfortunately, fascists in the past 25 years in Europe have killed several hundreds of people. So us, as anarchists, anti-fascists, were fighting them using all different kinds of tactics, you know, stickers, posters, campaigns, most often blockades, which usually ended up by clashes with police, because police were always protecting Nazis marching our cities. And then soon anti-fascist actions started to monitor and, of course, attack particular Nazis, like the leaders of the groups, and their property, like shops, cars, bars, in order to destabilize the fascist movement. And we have succeeded. We managed to kick these scumbags out of the streets, and in most of Czech cities, the white power skinheads are not a threat anymore on the streets. Which, that could look like great history, right? A great victory. But it's really nothing to celebrate, because now we're facing much worse and more dangerous kind of fascism, which has been emerging not only in Czech Republic, but all over the Europe. And it's not anymore a top few hundred of boneheads who will be marching the streets and having swastikas on their shirt, being basically hated by everyone. But who we see now are people who we went to school with and thought that they were our friends, or even our teachers, or some of my comrades, even their parents, joining these new anti-immigrant and white supremacist movements by thousands. These movements call themselves very often autonomous nationalists, and that's exactly what Z was just talking about, that if we don't make sure that we spread our tactics together with our values, there'll be always somebody who will steal our tactics, most often our enemy, and use them against us. And our enemy number one, or who will steal it most likely in Europe, is fascists, or in worst case, non-profits or NGOs. Though they are self-organized and autonomous, they still play a very important role for the state fascism, because they give great alibi to the politicians, who can point them out anytime they need, and they say, look, it wasn't us who burned down the house full of a Roma family sleeping in it. Roma people is the biggest minority in Eastern Europe. Or they can say, hey, it wasn't us, it was them, who, pointing to the fascists who attacked the refugee camp. So under this great coverage, the politicians can pretend being the anti-fascist ones, but still put in more and more racist and nationalist laws. So after developing this for a long time successful tactic of militant anti-fascism, over 2 decades after it, we realized that it has no use anymore, and it's upon us, anti-fascists all over the world, to figure out how we're gonna face and oppose this new wave of fascism emerging all over the place. In addition to fighting fascists, there is another enemy to fight for us as anarchists. And of course, it's the state. This year, just a few days before May Day, police of Czech Republic started the biggest nationwide crackdown against any social movement in recent Czech history, this time against anarchists and animal liberation movement. They call it Operation Phoenix, which in English is Phoenix. And in one night, police raided several flats or social centers or places like this and arrested countless of people. In the end of the day, 6 people remained in custody jail, or 3 people remained in custody jail, and together with another 3, 6 together were accused of a conspiracy of a preparation, a terrorist attack against a train with military equipment. And as I said, this was first time we experienced something like that, so many comrades and many people in the movement got scared and they stepped back. They're like, wow, how are we going to deal with this situation? Because, look, it's a big repression, big deal, and our comrades are accused of planning the terrorist attack, terrorism. So if we're gonna support them, we're gonna be seen as terrorists as well. We're gonna lose all the popularity which we are building in the past many years, and we're gonna put ourselves under big risk. I think, in contrary, that if our friends, comrades, or whoever is accused of terrorism or extremism or any term which state will bring, we have to oppose even louder in our narrative. And we do have to support them. Because if we don't, we just show the authorities and law enforcement that their tactics were successful, and anytime they want to oppress us or the most radical part of scene, they can oppress us one by one by one using the same tactics and the same narrative, because they will know that we will always make the step back. And instead of looking at it like, oh, you know, maybe the trial will show that they didn't actually plan it, because who knows, maybe they are innocent, let's wait for that and then we can support them. To me, much more legitimate questions are, look at it from the point of view, as my friend always says, how does that distribute power? And to me, if I see somebody is accused of preparation and attack against a train with military equipment, I just need to say it's a cargo train with no people in it, my questions would be, what is military equipment used for? How many people would die if a military equipment of a scale one train would be used in a warfare? Who are the usual casualties? And who profits from wars? If I answer these questions to myself, actually such a sabotage against this kind of train can save many lives. I'm not saying you guys go out and start to blow up trains and other stuff. What I'm saying, if you do any courageous action like that, you got my full support and hopefully support of the people in the room as well. This time, it showed that entire Operation Phoenix, or like these questions that I was just putting up, became irrelevant. Because guess what? The entire Operation Phoenix was just police entrapment. By that I mean, at least two agents, provocateurs, infiltrated a group of anarchists. They gained the trust. They bugged their flat. And they were the ones who started to talk and brought the idea of attacking the train in order to imprison them and discredit the movement. It was already really bad, but unfortunately this wasn't enough for the authorities. And just 2 months later, we read about another attack. This time somebody was supposed to throw a Molotov cocktails on the House of Minister of Defense. It all looks strange because anarchists never used this kind of tactics in Czech recent history before. There was actually no fire, no firemen were called, no evidence at all. But of course, it turned against us. This time, it hit me even harder or closer than the first wave of repressions, because it was my friend Igor who was accused of this bogus attack against the House of Minister of Defense. Now, with 7 detainees, or like some of them are bailed out, awaiting trial, and all of them, or some of them, might face up to life in prison. This was the first time when Czech police used such a tactics as entrapment, or did such a big wave of repression against social movement, and it was very, very first time when in Czech anyone was framed as a terrorist. So we got angry, like, why are they framing us as terrorists, and why are they doing this now, when a fascist movement is actually growing so quickly, and why they didn't use these terms few years ago, when actually fascists burned down the flat or house full of people sleeping in it, or killed several people. I mean, the answer why, like, terrorism. You probably know better than me, living here in so-called United States, what is the term used for and used by who. But why all of that is happening now? I see that people, as all over the world, as in Czech Republic, facing economical crisis, political crisis, and now this new thing, which was introduced in the beginning, so-called the refugee crisis. And as well, they read about the threat of war with Russia in the newspaper once a week at least. And in such a conditions, people are much more likely to seek for alternatives than any time past 25 years. So I believe that our movement can offer, if it's going to be open enough and militant enough at the same time, can offer these alternatives to the people, and it can be very dangerous to the authorities. So this is the best way how to discredit us and put us out of the game. Because at the same time, the actual Minister of Defense, who said that his house was attacked, is actually signing contracts about US military presence on a Czech land and new American bases. And of course, his argument is the threat of war with Russia. So when I look back and see last past 6 months in Czech Republic, it doesn't really seem to me like a coincidence that the agents provocateurs choose the military terrain as the target. And nor doesn't surprise me that my friend Igor was the one who was accused of this bogus attack against the House of Minister of Defense, because first of all, Igor is very active anarchist, and second, which is the most important part of the story, he is a Russian citizen. And that plays very well in political discourse of Czech Republic. It would sound like a joke if the situation wasn't that serious, but police actually framed Igor as pro-Putin anarchist. So it just plays very well for what is happening in Czech. Of course, media take it, they got a sensation on the first page, headlines, and sell it. I think it's important to realize that police didn't solve any problems. I mean, when police solve problems, right? But they were the ones who created the problems. Without police and without these agents, there would be no case of terrorism at all. And the same place for the nationalists. Like, now there is a big trend in Europe to closing down the borders. And if you think what the borders are for, we present in here a project being translated to more than 25 languages, people from many different countries. Borders are just to separate us into smaller groups, so the authorities have it much easier to control us and control the flow of people, when at the same time the flow of capital have no limits. You know, like there's basically no limits for supranational corporations profiting from destroying the earth and all the life on the planet. All these things I'm talking about, as has been said in the beginning, it's not to show some exotic struggle somewhere, or not to show what is happening in a country which is probably smaller than North Carolina. It's more to connect it with the broader events all over the world. And to me, all of these things happening all over the world is just tools maintaining capitalism, especially in crisis, or maintaining state in capitalism, especially in crisis. When I was talking about police repression, you know, it's not just Czech problem. It was Operation Pandora and Pinata. Maybe you heard about it in Spain, which up till this point in last year, about 70 people are framed as terrorists from, our people, anarchists. Here in USA, from COINTELPRO over Red Scare, Green Scare, Eric McDavid, all these cases of repressions, or Mexico, Zapatistas, Normalistas, you probably know what I mean by repressions being all over the place. The same with nationalism. Outermost nationalists or state fascists are getting more and more popular all over Europe now, and we're facing the biggest wave of fascism probably from Second World War. Germany started to close the borders, part with some of their neighbors, and me and Ramona, we were looking really like, oh, this is crazy. And then Slovenia did the same, then partly Croatia did the same, and then like Hungary on and off, and partly Austria, Italy. Hungary actually built the fences all around the country. Slovenia is starting to build the fences partly from the country to make Schengen, like the fortress Europe. So it's a big problem. And now we hear from Zihau in Brazil, people calling for military dictatorship. So, you know, all of these things are happening all over the planet at the same time, which to me just proves that in capitalism, fascism is always prevalent. But sometimes it seems like some countries in economic bubble, so it's like more free. But when a crisis hits, the authorities will always like use fascism as the guarding dog, as the ghost being under the bed, which grows with our fear. That to me means that we can't just fight or see our resistance as single issue politics or separated cases only. Like, rather, if we want to gain leverage over our lives, we have to see our struggles in much wider and bigger perspectives. And in every resistance we are involved in, fight against state and capitalism as well, and against all forms of oppression. Also, not just the ones behind the door, but the forms of oppression within our communities too. I think our real power lies in seeking the connections through across nations, ethnics, race, gender, sex, you can name it. Because if we don't, and if we fell in trap of this like nationalist game, what is going to happen if the nationalists will be more successful? They'll in Czech close the borders too. And then with first price hitting, which of course will, because we still will be living in capitalism, that's not, nationalists don't try to solve that, they will start war. Just as it happened in Ukraine about 1 year ago. So I think instead of participating on international war, we should promote international solidarity against local repressions and nationalism. What I mean by solidarity against repressions, probably everyone can imagine, you know, like support prisoners, liberate all the prisoners, because we all sooner or later can become prisoners, and abolish prison industrial complex as the most fundamental agent of racial division, especially here in the US. I mean, it sounds easy, I don't know how, but you get the idea what I'm talking about, right? Yeah, what is solidarity against nationalism? When I was saying in the beginning that a lot of our tactics don't work anymore, we have to find new tactics. Solidarity to me just doesn't fight fascism, but as well prevents it, and most importantly creates ties and networks between us and among us and people who are more targeted than us. By us, I mean, in my case, people who have this privilege of having European passport in their pockets. The examples of solidarity can be now brave people who break in through those sealed borders down in Balkans, or do actions which force authorities to open the borders to allow the immigrants having free transit up to the north. When at the same time, people from Central Europe or other parts of Europe driving down, offering any kind of support, material goods, or very often free seat in their car to take people up to the north. Of course, destroying the border or breaking through the borders, so-called smuggling people, it's illegal. But we shouldn't fall under what is legal or not, but again, like, think what it would cost if we don't take action, and how much harm we can do if we do take action. And I think if we think about it in this case, it's very easy to imagine what happened to the people if we not showed our solidarity to them. And of course, people don't do it for profit neither. Like, people do it because they feel some need of providing solidarity. All of these actions are happening on local scale, especially what our comrades in Balkans are doing, but it responds to big global problem, and I think that's very important. I would like to wrap up my talk with sharing an experience with recent struggles against repression, and that is every struggle or fight we are involved in, my experience was that it's much better and make more sense to follow our own heart, our own feelings, and stick to our own agenda, stick to our own guns, rather than felt in the trap of the legality I was talking about, or popularity. You know, people sometimes tend to look too much how media or TV talk about us, or how many social media likes they have. Honestly, I think it's much better to be hated for what we are than to be liked for what we are not. And my positive experience was that actually in the end of the day, perhaps week or month, we might be surprised of how many people will join our sincere action. Thank you.
All of the stories that my friends have told are stories about victories. They're stories in which people, in many cases a small number of people, organized to confront their immediate problems and were able to make a big difference in the context that they were struggling in. But they're also all stories in which these victories opened up new challenges, opened up new questions, opened up new problems. There are fascists on the street. You organize to fight them. You push them off the streets. You think you've won. You turn around and you see that the rest of society behind your back was becoming more and more nationalist, more and more fascist. The government is forcing austerity programs on you. You're struggling. You rise up. You overthrow the government. You create truly democratic assemblies. The problems of capitalism remain. And those assemblies are the new obstacle to being able to do the things that it would take to solve your problems. And the story in Brazil, they raise the bus fare by 20 cents. You get millions of people onto the streets protesting and force them not to increase the bus fare. 2 years later, your country is no longer in an economic bubble, and then the government can't compromise anymore. They raise the bus fare by 50 cents. You try to stop them, you can't. And the next thing you know, the people who were on the streets with you before, who were so proud of that victory, are looking around for other ways to solve their problems, like calling for the return of the military dictatorship. From my perspective, all of these stories are examples of why it's essential that we don't see ourselves as fighting individual opponents or individual problems, trying to solve individual issues. We're not up against specific pieces of legislation or specific fascists or specific police. We're up against systems. And if we don't have a systemic understanding, a holistic analysis of what it is we're trying to do, we will always be confounded by the ways that even our victories put us into new challenges, present us with new versions of the same old problems. This is a reason to have these conversations intercontinentally as well, to be in international dialogue, because these are not just local struggles, local movements, exotic uprisings. These are the same issues, the same struggles, the same problems that we are confronting in some version here in the United States, here in Asheville, North Carolina. And we won't be able to understand how they work or draw on examples of victories against them unless we are talking intercontinentally. That was the reason that we organized to get the four of us and another friend of ours from Argentina, who did some of this tour with us, to travel all around the United States so that Pendleton, Oregon, and Kansas City, Missouri, can be in dialogue with Ljubljana in Slovenia and Sao Paulo in Brazil, so that we can understand ourselves as a global network of people in struggle against global capitalism. To speak a little bit about which of these stories from overseas have resonated with my experience here. First, the story about democracy from Slovenia. We had Occupy, and we had the same debates and the same conflicts there, you know. How are we supposed to understand the General Assembly? Is it basically a less efficient version of the state legislature? Are we doing some kind of governance, just more gruelingly horizontal? Or should we better understand these movement spaces, these opportunities, as places where we can encounter each other and our collective potential differently, in a truly decentralized and autonomous way? At the end of the Occupy movement, I remember there was a fierce debate. Well, there were many fierce debates, but the one that I remember best was over the question of how we should be coordinating. Some people, perhaps represented best by a journalist named Chris Hedges, argued that the most important thing was to have something that was easy for everyone to do and that everyone could agree about. This is sort of like Adbuster's original call to get everyone into the streets. We'll agree on one demand and ceaselessly repeat it until Obama is forced to capitulate. I'm quoting the Adbuster's call. And Hedges thought that, you know, you get as many people as you can into the streets, all holding their sign, calling for the same thing, around some kind of lowest common denominator. He believed that this was what had toppled the Soviet bloc. I mean, if you look at the Soviet bloc, former Soviet bloc now, you can see how great that worked.
Yeah.
Against this sort of lowest common denominator perspective, the alternative, arguably less democratic, was the idea that anarchists had, that in the United States right now, people don't feel entitled to do any of the things that would actually suffice to change our society. We don't feel that we have the right to. We saw our role as being to push the envelope, to demonstrate that things were possible, that people right now are not able to imagine, are not able to feel that they have the right to do. To demonstrate those things so they might enter the public imagination, so that people might be able to imagine themselves doing those things. Perhaps not at first, but sooner or later. This is the other idea of how social movements can grow and gain power. An idea based in autonomy. And I believe that the way that the Black Lives Matter movement gained momentum in Ferguson concludes this argument. That it wasn't a million people sitting together in General Assemblies trying to decide how they could best reach consensus about which protest tactics and points of unity would be most valuable for confronting white supremacy. But rather, it was the courage of the people who were in the most affected situations, acting freely, you know, burning the Quick Trip, confronting the police immediately. That was what catalyzed that movement. So that's the question of democracy, how we structure decision-making in our movements. Another theme that resonates with me from the stories here is this question about demand. In Brazil, it was this question where people were saying every movement should find its 20 cents. Are we going to overthrow capitalism 20 cents at a time? To put it differently, is there any amount of protest activity that could force the free market to work in everyone's best interest? That could compel a profit-driven economy to function to everyone's betterment. You know? Maybe if we just protested harder, maybe if we just organized our union drives better, you know, maybe if we could just get some really good militant reformism going on, we could make the system work in everyone's best interest. If we don't believe that that's the case, but we organize around single issues rather than presenting our vision of a total change, not only we, but everyone else will be confused also when our movements fail or when they succeed and nothing changes. You block the increase of the bus fare, but actually everything proceeds the way it was, and then the people that you mobilize are looking around for something else to fix their problems. And what's waiting? Nowadays, it's nationalism and fascism in many cases. I think I've been arguing this for a while, but I believe it's more clearly true than ever that it's more realistic now to talk about changing everything than it is to think that we could fix our society one issue at a time. This is what it means to be confronting systemic problems. The crises that we face, the economic crisis, the ecological crisis, all of these crises cannot be adjusted 20 cents at a time. But there are two visions of systemic change as well. One is the one that we are arguing for, that we deconstruct, disable, destroy the prevailing system, all of the different mechanisms that impose inequalities between us, all of the different mechanisms that impose control on us. Total liberation for everyone, right? Not a blueprint, but that we get together and talk about what we want our lives to look like, and confront all the forces that are preventing them from looking that way. The other model for systemic change is talking about nationalism and fascism, and this is it. The idea that the apparent abundance of capitalism and all the infrastructure of social democracy could be preserved, but not for everyone. You just have to narrow the criteria of who counts as a person, whose interests should be preserved. This is what you could call the gated community model. The United States is a gated community. Citizenship can be a kind of gated community. Property ownership is also a sort of gated community. For Dylan Roof, race is the gated community that he would like to impose to create the haves and the have-nots, to draw those lines. There are many different forms that this could take. ISIS is yet another example of a group that is mobilizing around a line of inclusion and exclusion. We can see the world breaking into sort of a new balkanization, breaking into different groups that are in conflict over ethnic or religious or class interests. You know. And people, many people will turn to this vision of social change if another vision is not clear. Where are anarchists in all of this? I want to argue that for the last 15 or 20 years, we have done a great job of popularizing our tactics and popularizing our rhetoric of autonomy. Speaking to rooms of 15 or 20 people at a time, you know, acting in demonstrations of up to 100 people. The Black Bloc in Seattle, the World Trade Organization, was less than 100 people. The famous Black Bloc that you've probably all heard of. Acting in small groups, we have had a huge impact on what tactics people can imagine utilizing. But we haven't been as successful in popularizing our vision of another way of life, of another way of relating to each other. Back in the anti-globalization era, in the time of the Seattle WTO protests, our fantasy was that one day there could be a social movement where everybody worked by a consensus. Right? That seemed impossible to us. I was there and I remember it was like, if only everyone would use consensus, it wouldn't be capitalism or democracy, it would be something else. And we got to see that with Occupy. Or this other model, you know, the more recent model of if only everybody would occupy everything. That was an anarchist banner in 2009 that seemed crazy, you know. Occupy everything. What are you talking about? 2 years later, occupying everything is on the agenda for millions of people around the world. In this model, this Occupy model, you set up in a plaza, the police try to evict you, you defend it, you know, you have a standoff with them. This model that actually has overthrown governments. Well, if you look at how it was used in Ukraine, it did overthrow governments, but it was utilized by nationalists and out-and-out Nazis to advance their agenda. That makes us anarchists look like the risk-tolerant startup company, you know, that developed this methodology that could then be appropriated wholesale by more powerful actors. This is the danger of just spreading tactics, or even just spreading this vision of this demand for autonomy. There are many, many different ways to be autonomous, right? So the reason for us to be on this tour is to try to draw attention back to our total vision for social change. This idea that we could confront all of the different mechanisms that impose different forms of oppression. That we could change everything. And this is why we still believe, more now than ever, actually, that it's important to use this word, anarchy, which says something different from just saying freedom, which could be George Bush or something, or even just saying autonomy. But the most convincing, the most compelling evidence for me that it's important now to assert that we are anarchists is that we're seeing this word, this concept, the position of being against the authorities. We're seeing people on the right wing trying to usurp this also. So-called anarcho-capitalists, for example. It's up to us, when it comes to framing the public imagination, contributing to what people can imagine, it's up to us to show that we're not just talking about being against the authorities, we're talking about being against all authorities and the potential of complete and total liberation. Thank you for listening to me. And to all of our stories tonight.
You're listening to
The X Worker.
An audio strike
against a monotone world.
Due to time constraints and privacy concerns, we're not including the full discussion and Q&A that took place after the panel spoke. But we do want to include the panelists' response to the final question from the audience, which asked about how To Change Everything was collaboratively written and translated, how the various versions across languages and national contexts differ, and the reactions they've gotten to the project.
Maybe I'll start with the English version. We can ask it around. You know, like most crime think projects, the initial version started with a bunch of drafts and discussion among an anonymous network of individuals who know each other for a long time, and debate about what different parts should look like, circulating different versions. And then as we got deeper into it, we started to have those conversations more and more internationally. And be like, you know, who wants to be part of coordinating this, like, internationally, you know? And it doesn't need to be all the same thing, actually. Like, it should all be, like, adjusted according to context. So you want to take it from there.
Yeah, and this is then, it wasn't just us influencing, like, the English text, but it was also with the translations. It wasn't just translating, but it was actually also changing. I can speak for the Slovenian version. We have adapted not just pictures to make it more locally contextualized, but also a lot of examples and some of the things that we felt were perhaps working in some other context, but we felt it's important to emphasize something else in our own context. The reason why we agreed to this project when we were approached by the idea was that during the uprising, one of the things that we realized was, you know, we have like this anarchist newspaper bulletin, and we would, I remember we distributed it one, like hundreds and hundreds of copies on one protest, and the next day people were coming, hey, do you have a new issue? And we were like, come on, people, you know, like wait 2 months or three or four. But the thing is that in a space, space between the upheavals is sometimes much more closed for new radical ideas to be tested than it is during during periods where everything opens up and everyone wants to experiment with new things. And for us, we realized that we don't have enough outreach text, you know, when people were asking, hey, but what is anarchism? You know, I mean, of course, we try to answer it the best way possible, but it's always very helpful if you can actually give people, you know, a text that can be a tool of conversation to continue, for it to continue. So for us, this kind of text was exactly what we needed in that situation, what was lacking in our context. So therefore, we were really enthusiastic and started after we printed it out with help of international friends who donated a lot of funds for us to make that happen. We started a very ambitious tour that literally visited every village. Well, not every, but you get the picture. Like, we were going into not just big cities, but also a lot of smaller ones, and meeting people and talking about it. And what was really interesting for us, that people who were already in radical politics were like, oh yeah, that's great, you know, we signed this, like, we totally are on the same page. But what was interesting for us, that it brought out people to our events who were not familiar with anarchism before, who have gone through uprising, or maybe not even that. But that text, kind of, the way that they were talking to us about it, kind of helped them understand, I won't go as far as to say conditions of their oppression, but definitely ways that made them feel less lonely in their everyday struggle, and helped them to perhaps start thinking and having conversations about what it means to fight against some of those things, and what it means to find people, you know, that can fight alongside with them. So, for me, this is why I still believe in that text, because I have a feeling that it's not, you know, the text for me is not a goal of just producing a pamphlet and distributing it all over and then having nice little tours around it. But I understand it as a tool of conversation, of starting this conversation that can go in many different places, way beyond what this text is bringing.
In Brazil, we have like an entire collective dedicated to translate and discuss, adapt things that can resonate with Brazilian reality. Like, since the pictures, of course, many people won't know what is KKK, blonde kids hugging a tree, looks like a diaper advertising. So we thought about how the image is like, talking with people there, and how like the good examples, like things working, or like, if you want to talk about racism, we'll use terms that resonate with people in Brazil, like, you got the idea. But then we made like 5,000 copies in Brazil, like 200 million people. 5,000 copies don't seem too much compared to 100,000 copies here in the United States, but it was like shocking. People, whoa, 5,000 copies of something like anarchist publication for free, like, this is like had a big impact in a country like Brazil when people has limited access to resources. And actually, it's the fanciest thing I was involved with. I usually do photocopy shitty things, and it's for free. Like, it's kind of weird when people see it on the table, they take it first. But was very interesting to build this dialogue after, like, it was released in the end of 2014. We would like to do it before, but we couldn't, by many technical problems. But
they finished it months before any other group finished their version, though, actually. They're just, you know.
We were like, send us the draft! And they were like, wait a little bit. And then to work on it. So it was important, like, after World Cup and many other, in 2013 World Cup, like, people were like, wanted to keep on the streets, maybe push forward the discussion and the actions and everything. I think it will be like a great moment to spread like basically anarchist values and reasons to be like still angry, still like wanting to do something that is not like just against fair hike, against like World Cup. If there's no World Cup, if there's no fair hike, nobody will see each other. Like, come on, like, let's be fighting for something like the worth for our lives. And then we decided to do a website like in Portuguese, like paramudartudo.com. Like, so no one will remember, like, to change to work. Okay? And then there we put all the text. We made some posters, things like people download, put on the streets or bedrooms or whatever. The video, everything. We did a map like of separated by state, like, of collectives and social centers, collectives, events, cooperatives, everything like anarchists are doing. So people were like, oh, they got very nice. I agree with this, but what anarchists do? And then they go there and find someone close to them to get involved, to get like, to ask something, to know. Is this still a list? We want to do a map, but we need some technical experience that we don't have yet. But the website is kind of good for like a very do-it-yourself thing. No, we didn't pay anybody. We're like learning to do this while we were doing and try to keep like in touch with a blog, Facebook page, all this shit. That it's bad, but that's what people are using. So keeping like updating news and other texts and indicating things and doing like, what is, for example, cooperative for blah blah blah. And then we list like many cooperatives and talk a little bit about it. What is anarchist Black Cross? When we need support and with an anarchist approach. We go to and ask, talk with anarchist Black Cross, because of the independent media, we put indie media and all the other like anarchist medias we have. So this kind of thing, that keep updating like tools for the new people that are appearing. We saw like increasing of people wanting to join student groups, reading groups, or any kind of activity in any context after like 2013. Because anarchism became famous, because of the slogan of the Circle A and the Black Blocs. Well, what the hell? What is behind this? So yeah, that it's going for us. It's like going like, as a project that will like be a kind of gathering for many other things, not just like importing part of a project. It's like we are like using this opportunity. Like, it's happening all over the world, 26 countries. Yeah, to show that there's no borders, there's no nothing that can stop us. So let's do here too, and being cool, we can do other things in the future, like slowly. Let's see, we're going for the next printing. Let's see if this the end of this year or the beginning of the new year, we can do another 10,000 and see what goes next.
In Czech we did like something like this, but smaller tour in there. And with the project, what I learned here from Z and Ramona, like, I see that we could have done much more, but always the resources and energy and the capacity is all we got. So back then it was the maximum we could have done, but now one of the things back what we are talking, we're going to bring back is all of these experiences, what this project can offer. So a lot of things could have been done better, or hopefully will. And that brings me to, you know, to this talk about start anywhere, that like with this thing, like, I don't think that we should be scared that we might lose, because it's not the worst thing, not the most scary thing to me. Like, the worst thing is if you don't even start. Mm-hmm. And that's to me like about this project, like, hopefully we're gonna get somewhere like farther with that. And this tour, as from the last tour from the project, it opened already a lot of network to me, a lot of connections, which as proof is me being here and a lot of connections back home. But it can be much farther, so yeah, to change everything, start anywhere.
Thanks so much for having us here.
Yeah.
That, dear listeners, was the Two Change Everything Tour's international panel discussion. This fall, we presented 59 events in 57 towns, speaking with well over 2,000 people altogether. But, as ambitious as that was, we know it was just a fraction of the places and people with interest in anarchist ideas, let alone the number of folks with whom it's important to engage to reimagine the world and how we might, well, change everything. So it's crucial that we continue this process of connection and collaboration and dialogue. And we have a few ideas about how to do that. First of all, if you took part in organizing an event on the tour, and you've got a local crew of folks interested in anarchism who want to continue acting and thinking together, we've got some ideas. Folks in different crews in different cities are hatching a plan for coordinated reading groups to keep on engaging with the ideas discussed on the tour and that vitally impact how we conduct our struggles at home. For starters, CrimeThink will be releasing a text in early 2016 synthesizing our critiques of democracy, including historical and theoretical background, as well as a litany of contemporary case studies illustrating the limits of democracy within social struggles. We invite comrades across the country to organize reading groups on this text and others. We will help arrange for discussion between groups. Feel free to get in touch if this sounds interesting, and stay posted to the podcast and the CrimeThink blog for more updates. If you weren't able to organize or attend a Two Change Everything tour event in your area, but you're interested and you suspect you're not the only one, drop us a line and let's start scheming for the next time around. 2016 will see more events and tours from CrimeThink and related anarchist projects. So, you'll have more opportunities. Let's start laying the groundwork for future events and collaborations. And, last but not least, we are soliciting contributions for our Year in Review episode. If you missed it last time, you can scroll back to episode 33 to hear the kind of thing we're thinking about. Or, if you want to evaluate our guesses about what this past year would hold, I think we did a pretty good job. For this new episode, if you'd like to offer any reflections on 2015, the most significant happenings of the year in the news or the anarchist worlds you're a part of, strategic developments in protest or resistance, etc., or any predictions for 2016, what you think will be significant, what anarchists should be looking out for, etc., then please drop us a line. Our email address, as always, is podcast@crimethink.com. If you'd like us to include your thoughts in the episode, we'd need to get them from you by about December 20th. Sorry about the short notice. But even if you send them later, we're interested in your thoughts and would love to open up a dialogue. So that's it for this episode. You can read the full transcript of the Two Change Everything tour panel discussion you just heard, along with links to reflections written by tour participants and other info, on our website at crimethink.com/podcast. In our next episode, we'll revisit borders, migration, and the so-called refugee crisis in Europe and beyond. Till then, thanks for listening.